Another teaching from the same collection recounts the story of a wanderer named Bahia. He stopped the Buddha on the street in Savatthi and said, "Venerable Sir, you are the Samana Gotama. Your Dhamma is famous throughout the land. Please teach me that I may understand the truth." The Buddha replied, "We're on our alms round, Bahia. This is not the right time. Life is uncertain, Venerable Sir. We never know when we're going to die. Please teach me the Dhamma." This dialogue repeats itself three times. Three times over, the Buddha says the same thing, and Bahia responds in the same way. Finally, the Buddha says, "When a Tathagata is pressed three times, he has to answer. Listen carefully, Bahia, and attend to what I say. In the seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. In the sensed, there is only the sensed. In the cognized, there is only the cognized. Thus you should see that indeed there is no thing here. This, Bahia, is how you should train yourself. Since, Bahia, there is for you, in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard, in the sensed, only the sensed, in the cognized, only the cognized, and you see that there is no thing here, you will therefore see that there indeed there is no thing there. As you see that there is no thing there, you will see that you are therefore located neither in the world of this nor in the world of that, nor any place in betwixt the two. This alone is the end of suffering." And that's Udana 1.10. Upon hearing these words, Bahia was immediately enlightened. What does it mean to say there is no thing there? It is talking about the realm of the object. It implies that we recognize that the seen is merely the seen. That's it. There are forms, shapes, colors, and so forth, but there is no thing there. There is no real substance, no solidity, no self-existent reality. All there is the quality of experience itself. No more, no less. There is just seeing, hearing, feeling, sensing, cognizing. And the mind naming it all is just another experience. Quote, "The space of the Dhamma hall, Ajahn Amaro's voice. Here is the thought. Am I understanding this? Now another thought. Am I not understanding this? There is that seen, heard, tasted, and so on, but there is no thingness, no solid, independent entity that this experience refers to." As this insight matures, not only do we realize that there is no thing out there, but we also realize there is no solid thing in here, no independent and fixed entity that is the experiencer. This is talking about the realm of the subject. The practice of non-abiding is a process of emptying out the objective and subjective domains, truly seeing that both the object and the subject are intrinsically empty. If we can see that both the subjective and objective are empty, if there is no real in here or out there, where could the feeling of I-ness or me-ness or my-ness locate itself? As the Buddha said to Bahia, "You will not be able to find yourself either in the world of this subject or in the world of that object or anywhere else between the two." There is a similar and much lengthier exchange between the Buddha and Ananda in the Shirangama Sutra, which is the text much referred to in the Chan school of the Chinese tradition. For pages and pages, the Buddha asks Ananda in multifarious ways if he can define exactly where his mind is. No matter how hard he tries, Ananda cannot establish it precisely. Eventually, he is forced to the conclusion that, "I cannot find my mind anywhere." But the Buddha says, "Your mind does exist, though, doesn't it?" Ananda is finally drawn to the conclusion that where does not apply. This is the point of these teachings on non-abiding are trying to draw us to. The whole concept and construct of awareness, the act of conceiving ourselves as this individual entity living at this spot in space and time, is a presumption. And it's only by frustrating our habitual judgments in this way that we're forced into loosening our grip. I first started to investigate this type of contemplation when I was on a long retreat in our monastery and doing a lot of solitary practice. It suddenly occurred to me that even though I might have let go of the feeling of self, the feeling of this and that and so on, whatever the experience of reality was, it was still here. There was still this here-ness. For several weeks, I contemplated the question, Where is here? Not using the question to get a verbal answer, more just to illuminate and aid the abandonment of the clinging that was present. Recognizing this kind of conditioning is half the job. Recognizing that as soon as there is a here-ness, there's a subtle presence of a there-ness. Similarly, establishing a this brings up a that. As soon as we define inside, up pops outside. It's crucial to acknowledge such subtle feelings of grasping. It happens so fast, and at so many different layers and levels. This simple act of apprehending the experience is shining the light of wisdom onto the heart, on what the heart is grasping. Once the defilements are in the spotlight, they get a little nervous and uncomfortable. Clinging operates best when we're not looking. When clinging is the focus of our awareness, it can't function properly. In short, clinging can't cling if there's too much wisdom around. Page 25. Who and what do not apply? In order to discover the place of non-abiding, we have to find a way of letting go of the conditioned, the world of becoming. We need to recognize the strong identification we have with our bodies and personalities, with all of our credentials, and with how we take all as inaugurable truth. I am Joe Schmo. I was born in this place. This is my age. This is what I do for a living. This is who I am. It seems so reasonable to think like this, and on one level, it makes total sense. But when we identify with those concepts, there is no freedom. There is no space for awareness. But when we recognize how seriously and absolutely we take this identity, we open ourselves up to the possibility of freedom. We taste the sense of self and feel how gritty that is and how real it seems to be. In recognizing the feeling of it, we're able to know this is just a feeling. The feeling of I-ness and my-ness are as transparent as any other feelings. When the mind is calm and steady, I like to ask myself, who is watching? Who is aware? Who is knowing this? I also like asking, what is knowing? What is aware? What is practicing non-meditation? The whole point of posing questions like these is not to find answers. In fact, if you get a verbal answer, it is the wrong one. The point of asking who or what questions is to puncture our standard presumptions. In the spaciousness of the mind, the words who and what start sounding ridiculous. There is no real who or what. There is only the quality of knowing. And as we work with this in a more and more refined way, we see that feeling of personhood become more and more transparent. Its solidity falls away, and the heart is able to open and settle back further and further. Page 27. One does not apply. Time is another area in which we should notice subtle clinging. We may experience resting and awareness and have an attendant sense of clarity and spaciousness, but we may also have a firm sensation that this is happening now. When we do, without noticing it, we've turned that nowness into a solid quality. The process of letting go happens layer by layer. As one layer falls away, we can get all excited and think, oh great, I'm free now. It's all open space. All this open space is wonderful. But when we start to realize something isn't quite right here, there's still some stickiness in the system. We notice the solidification of time and the limitation we have created of the present. There's a verse about time by the 6th Zen patriarch that I love to quote. It says, "In this moment, there is nothing which comes to be. In this moment, there is nothing which ceases to be. Thus, in this moment, there is no birth and death to be brought to an end. Thus, the absolute peace is this present moment. Although it is just this present moment, there is no limit to this moment, and herein is eternal delight." Birth and death depend on time. Something apparently born in the past, living now, will die in the future. Once we let go of time, and if we also let go of thingness, we see there can be no real thing coming into being or dying. There is just the suchness of the present. In this way, there is no birth or death to be brought to an end. That is how this moment is absolutely peaceful. It is outside of time, akaliko. We use such phrases as this moment, but they're not quite accurate because they still can give us an impression of the present as a small fragment of time. For even though it is just a moment, the present is limitless. In letting go of the structures of the past and future, we realize that this present is an infinite ocean, and the result of this realization is living in the eternal, the timeless. We needn't solidify and conceive the present in contradistinction to a past or a future. It is its own self-sustaining vastness. We're talking here about the abandonment of clinging at a very subtle level, a practice that takes a lot of quick and careful spiritual footwork. When we see our mind getting caught up with something, we can apply the classic Vipassana technique. Just hit it with impermanence, not self and suffering. The old 1-2-3. If we have good sense of anatta, we chop it up with a not me, not mine, and down it goes. But it is important to remember that clinging is extraordinarily wily. There we are, gloating over our success, but we don't realize that this is a tag match that's going on. Another character is bearing down on us from behind while we look down at our knockout victim on the floor. The partner is about to clobber us. We just barely let go of the attachment to time when attachment to opinion starts moving full speed ahead. We drop that, then here-ness takes over. Then it's the body. Clinging takes shape in many, many different ways, and we need to notice them all. Up until the point when Ajahn Chah met his teacher, Ajahn Mun, he said that he never really understood that mind and its objects existed as separate qualities, and that because of getting the two confused and tangled up, he could never find peace. But what he had got from Ajahn Mun in those 3 short days he spent with him was the clear sense that there is the knowing mind, the puru, the one who knows, and then there are the objects of knowing. These are like a mirror and the images that are reflected in it. The mirror is utterly unembellished and uncorrupted by either the beauty or the ugliness of the objects appearing in it. The mirror doesn't even get bored. Even when there is nothing reflected in it, it is utterly equanimous, serene. This was a key insight for Ajahn Chah, and it became a major theme for his practice and teaching from that time onward. He would compare the mind and its objects to oil and water contained in the same bottle. The knowing mind is like the oil, and the sense impressions are like the water. Primarily because our minds and lives are very busy and turbulent, the oil and water get shaken up together, and thus appear that the knowing mind and its objects are all one substance. But if we let the system calm down, then the oil and the water separate out. They are essentially immiscible. There's the awareness, the Buddha mind, and the impressions of thought, the sensory world, and all the patterns of consciousness. The two naturally separate out from each other. We don't have to do a thing to make it happen. Intrinsically, they are not mixed. They will separate themselves out if we let them. At this point, we can truly see that the mind is one thing and the mind objects are another. We can see the true nature of mind, mind essence, which knows experience and in which all of life happens. And we can see that the transcendent quality is devoid of relationships to individuality, space, time, and movement. All of the objects of the world, its people, our routines, and mind states appear and disappear within that space. Page 66. Is the sound annoying you? In this respect, it's again striking to me how closely the language of Dzogchen Chiching matched the kind of expressions used by the Thai forest masters. These are exactly the kinds of teachings they dwell on and employ a great deal, particularly my own teacher, Ajahn Chah. If people were trying to meditate and wanted to shut the world out, he used to give them a very hard time. If he came across a nun or monk who had barricaded the windows of their heart and was trying to block everything out, he would really put them through it. One monk of this type he drew in as his attendant for a while, and he would never let him sit still. As soon as he saw the monk close his eyes to go into meditation, he would immediately send him off on some errand. Ajahn Chah knew that cutting yourself off was not the place of true inner peace. This was because of his own years of trying to make the world shut up and leave him alone. He failed miserably. Eventually, he was able to see this is not how to find completion and resolution. Years ago, he was a wandering monk living on his own on a mountainside above a village and keeping a strict meditation schedule. In Thailand, they love outdoor night-long film shows because the nights are cool compared to the very hot days. Whenever there was a party, it tended to go on all night. About 50 years ago, public address systems were just starting to be used in Thailand, and every decent event had a PA going. It blasted as loud as possibly could all through the night. One time, Ajahn Chah was quietly meditating up in the mountain while there was a festival going on down in the village. All the local folk songs and pop music were amplified throughout the area. Ajahn Chah was sitting there, seething and thinking, "Don't they realize all the bad karma involved in disturbing my meditation? They know I'm up here. After all, I'm their teacher. Haven't they learned anything? And what about the five precepts? I bet they're boozing and out of control." And so on and so forth. But Ajahn Chah was a pretty smart fellow, and he listened to himself complaining. He quickly realized, "Well, they're just having a good time down there. I'm making myself miserable up here. No matter how upset I get, my anger is just making more noise internally." And then he had this insight. "Oh, the sound is just the sound. It's me who's going out to annoy it. If I leave the sound alone, it won't annoy me. It's just doing what it has to do. That's what sound does. It makes sound. That's its job. So if I don't go out and bother the sound, it's not going to bother me." As it turned out, this insight had a profound effect that it became the principle that he espoused from that time on. And if any of the monks display any urge to try to get away from people, stimulation, the world of things and responsibilities, he would tend to shove them straight into it. He would put that monk in charge of the cement mixing crew, or take him to do every house blessing that came up on the calendar. He would make sure that that monk had to get involved in things because he was trying to teach him to let go of seeing meditation as needing sterile conditions, to see, in fact, that most wisdom arises from the skillful handling of the world's abrasions. Ajahn Chah was passing along an important insight. It's pointless to try to find peace through nullifying or erasing the sense world. Peace only comes through not giving that world more substantiality or more reality than it actually possesses. Sometimes when I use the example of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, people still feel that this is a negation of the sense world. There is an intimation of condescension, a looking down on that. We get afraid when we hear people talking about dispassion towards the sense world, as it can offend our habits of life affirmation. The balance, as this is something we can experience for ourselves, is not in negation. It comes from when we stop creating each other and allow ourselves to relax into a pure quality of knowing. It's not fabricating the world, ourselves, or our stories. There is a gentle relaxation, and ironically, we find ourselves far more attuned to life than ever. This cannot happen while we are busy carrying around me and you. It's my life, and my past, and my future, and the rest of the world with all of its problems. Actually, the result of this relinquishment is not a kind of numbness or distancing, but an astonishing attunement. Buddhist cosmology and the stories of the suttas always have a historical, a mythical, and a psychological element to them. When we talk about the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, we sometimes wonder, was it actually that tree? Are we sure that he really sat beside the river near Bodhgaya? How can anyone know it was actually there? The story goes that perhaps the Buddha did sit under a tree, or a Nepalese prince sat under a tree, or something happened, or something stopped happening, somewhere in India a couple of thousand years ago or so. In other words, there's both historical and mythological aspects to the story, but the most crucial elements in how this maps onto our psychology. How does this symbolize our experience? The pattern of the story is that, even though the Buddha has totally penetrated the cycles of dependent origination and his heart is utterly free, Mara's army doesn't retreat. Mara has sent in the horrors. He has sent in his beautiful daughters. He's even sent in the parental pressure factor. "Well, son, you could have done a great job. You're such a natural leader. You would have made a great king. Now there's only your half-brother, Nanda, and he's a bit of a wimp. Not, No good on the battlefield. Well, I guess if you're going to do this monk thing, the kingdom is going to go rack and ruin. But that's all right. It's fine. You just do whatever you want to do. Just be aware that you're ruining my life. But don't worry. It's fine. It's okay. The forces of allure, fear, and responsibility are all there. Yet the Buddha doesn't close his eyes and escape into blissful absorption. As the armies of Mara come at him, he looks straight at them and says, I know you, Mara. I know what this is. The Buddha doesn't argue with Mara. He doesn't give rise to aversion towards Mara. He stays undiluted. He doesn't react against what's happening in that moment. No matter what Mara's armies do, none can get into the space under the Bodhi tree. All their weapons turn to flowers and incense and to beams of light illuminating the Vajra seat. But even when the Buddha's heart is totally liberated, Mara still won't retreat. He says to the Buddha, what right do you have to claim the royal seat at the immovable spot? I'm the king of this world. I'm the one who should be sitting there. I'm in charge here. I'm the one who deserves to be there, aren't I? And he turns around to his horde, his army 700,000 strong, and they all say, yes, indeed, sire. See, says Mara, everyone agrees. I belong there, not you. I'm supposed to be the great one. What happens then is that just as Mara has called his witnesses to back him up, the Buddha calls on the Mother Goddess, his witness. The Buddha reaches down to the ground, touches the earth, and calls forth the Earth Mother. She appears and says, this is my true son. He has every right to claim the Vajra seat at the immovable spot. He has developed all the virtues necessary to claim the sovereignty of perfect and complete enlightenment. You do not belong there, Mara. The Mother Goddess then produces a flood from her hair, and the armies of Mara are all washed away. It is very interesting that he thus did not become a fully enlightened teaching Buddha without the help of the Mother Goddess and then later the Father God. It was Brahma Sahampati, the creator god, the CEO of the universe, who came and asked the Buddha to teach. Without those two figures, he would not have left the immovable spot and he wouldn't have started teaching. So mythologically, there are some interesting little quirks to the tale. The Buddha's gentle gesture of touching the earth is a magnificent metaphor. It is saying that even though we might have this enlightenment, free space internally, it needs to be interfaced with the phenomenal world. Otherwise, there is no completion. This is why meditating with eyes open, in a way, is a useful bridge. We cultivate a vast internal space, but it is necessarily connected to the phenomenal world. If there is only an internal subjective experience of enlightenment, we're still caught. Mara's army won't retreat. The hassles are everywhere, the tax returns, the permits, the jealousies. We can see that they are all empty, but they still come at us from all directions. But in reaching out to touch the earth, the Buddha recognized, yes, there is that which is transcendent and unconditioned, but humility demands not simply holding to the unconditioned and the transcendent. The Buddha recognized and acknowledged that there is this, the conditioned, there is the sense world, there is the earth that makes up my body and my breath, and the food that I eat. That gesture of reaching out from the transcendent is saying, how could fully engaging with the sense world possibly corrupt the innate freedom of the heart? This freedom is uninterruptible, uncorruptible, unconfusable by any sense experience. Therefore, why not allow it all in? By openly, freely acknowledging the limited, needing to call the Great Mother to bear witness, for example, the unlimited manifests its full potential. If there is hesitancy and the caution to keep the conditioned at bay, that betrays a basic lack of faith in the natural inviolability of the unconditioned. Another phrase that expresses this same principle is chittang pabassarang akandukehi kilesehi, meaning the heart's nature is intrinsically radiant. Defilements are only visitors. It's pointing out the fact that the heart's nature is intrinsically pure and perfect. The things that appear to defile this purity are only visitors, passing through, just wandering or drifting by. The heart's nature cannot truly be corrupted by any of that.
Comments, questions? Here we have
pretty good balance of interaction and seclusion. I was wondering, maybe could you speak to how to integrate like interaction and physical seclusion to develop citta viveka or mental seclusion?
Well, I mean, and I think, especially because there's this aspect of, say, citta viveka is essentially samadhi. So that continuity and diligence of allowing the mind to keep returning to its object of meditation, and letting that mindfulness develop a continuity, seeing how mindfulness and samadhi are kind of inseparable. But then there's also the aspect of upadhi viveka, which is an aspect of, say, the viveka that comes from the relinquishing of those bases of attachment. So the citta viveka is under the stabilizing and settling of the mind, allowing them. Part of it is actually taking the time to delight in the quality of stillness or clarity or well-being. Because there's always going to be objects, or there's always going to be intrusion in terms of either external sense contact or internal proliferations. And we can focus on those and get irritated and upset or shaken by them. Or we can focus on the quality of clarity and stillness that is actually present. And so then that citta viveka starts to really establish itself. And that's also a bridge to the upadhi viveka.
Do you want to speak more about upadhi viveka? I think at one point I was asking Aganara about this, the difference between citta viveka and upadhi viveka. Uh-huh. And for some reason, I could be mistaken, but the sense was that, like what you just said, citta viveka is more related to samadhi, whereas upadhi viveka is more connected with wisdom.
Yeah.
But what's the difference in the experience?
Difference in experience is that, say, citta viveka is easily shaken. Upadhi viveka is more transportable. I mean, you can carry it with you. Whereas oftentimes citta viveka is dependent on conditions being suitable for us. And of course, there is an interaction between the two, as broad brush, that's what. So upadhi means, say literally, is what is it? Upadhi is the basis of attachment. So the upadhi is the basis of attachment. So that five khandhas, that seeing. Seeing and understanding and internalizing that impermanent, unsatisfactory, non-self nature of the five khandhas. Parvahave pancha khandha, what we chanted this morning. These five khandhas, these five aggregates are a burden. To react to a burden with aversion, or fear, or oppression is dukkha. To see the limitation of it and relinquish it with clarity and compassion, that's upadhi viveka.
Would it be true to say that citta viveka is like sort of a temporary stilling of the deep devices, and upadhi viveka is Liberation?
Yeah, certainly more on the on that flavor.
Okay.
On that end of the scale. Because there's also insights into upadi viveka that one has, one has to keep reflecting and investigating so that upadi viveka really stabilizes itself.
Ajahn Amaro mentioned the similarities of the Dzogchen practice, the Tibetan practice, and the Thai forest tradition, and it's that. In the sense of the knower and the objects, and also, I mean, Dzogchen, I think, is more about emptiness, but, or...
I think so. I don't know enough about the, say, most of my information on Dzogchen comes from some Tibetan teachings. It's kind of like is it more of an emptiness practice, taking Maha Mudra to another level? But I don't know enough about it. I think that was one of the things that really struck. Also, the context of this book is these are talks that Ajahn Amaro is giving to people who... The retreat was at Spirit Rock. The retreat was led by Sokmi Rinpoche, who is a Dzogchen master. And in order for Sokmi to be able to teach at Spirit Rock, he needed to share the retreat with another teacher. So Ajahn Amaro has known Sokmi for quite some time, and they love each other. So then Ajahn Amaro was there, but then because it's at Spirit Rock, then probably 60-70% of the people who were on the retreat were kind of Theravada, we Vipassanamics. And it was a bit out of their range of familiarity. And many of the people who were on that retreat were people who were in a real solid practice, a lot of experience, and then finding this quite new and different, and to a certain extent a bit, kind of uncertain. Where does this leave us? Where is it? What's this mean in terms of our context, our familiarity? Ajahn Amaro was taking the opportunity to give talks that drew the similarities out between these teachings.
For reference, I actually dropped a few references to terms and a few little bits in there that would have really stood out as what was that, because the rest of the book context could cover it, but I left them out for that very reason.
Just kind of curious, but when there's reference to Ajahn Chah telling the monk who he wanted to meditate to keep having to do chores and things like that, having lived with Lopur Chah, do you think that people got results in doing that? Because sometimes it seems almost exact opposite of what the suttas would say, because there's an empty tree, it's like...
Also Ajahn Amaro left out the bit that sometimes Ajahn Chah would tell people who were looking for business, get back to their kutta again. quit hanging around, keeping yourself occupied, and go back to your kutta. So it's that story of Ajahn Chah, where he sees somebody... all I do is see people walking down a road, and they're going off to the left into the ditch there, and I'm like, go right. And the opposite is true. So that is looking for balance. So and then of course the reality is at different times in our own practice, then those balances are also needed. But that and also the monk that Ajahn Amaro was referencing was a monk who was extremely adept at meditation. So his ability for his mind to go into samadhi took very little time, and his mind could stay in, say in jhana for an hour, 10 hours, 24 hours consistent. He just disappeared for 24 hours, 36 hours, no problem. It's solid. So then Ajahn Chah says, well, yeah, your mind can do that, but then when you come out, you're still, you get drawn to your desires, you get caught by your aversions. So that sense of the continuity of mindfulness and necessity for relinquishment.
At this aspect of Rinpoche's teaching, he emphasized more than anyone else I've heard, except Ajahn Sumedho, which obviously is from Ajahn Chah.
Right.
That within daily life, within interaction, within engagement, within activity, maintaining that, keeping that continuity.
Yeah.
It's quite extremely difficult, obviously.
Okay.
But, I'm just struck by it. I'm struck by that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'd say, and, you know, it really comes out of his experience as opposed to as a theory. And it's also from his own experience and from his teachers as well. That story of him being of Ajahn Chah sewing his robe and he's going to, and is in, he just completely, the whole world falls away. He's just working on his robe. He's sitting in the shade of started off under the shade of the tree. The sun has gone around. He's sitting in the blazing sun. He hasn't even noticed that. And his teacher comes along. You know, what's the big obsession? When are you? So that is, and Ajahn Ginnivi was somebody who trained with Ajahn Mun for a long time, and Ajahn Chah from because it really kind of upset him in the beginning living with Ajahn Ginnivi, because it's like Ajahn Chah's sitting, walking, it's meditation, let's get this meditation going. And it looked like Ajahn Kinnan, he's not doing anything, he's pottering around like an old man, fixing this thing and cleaning that up. But then it took him some time, and he said, he was peaceful all the time. So yeah.
A question for the two, Ajahn Asnan and Tom Paisla. I'm intrigued by your question because, when I hear stories about Ajahn Mun, just how impeccable everything was. So it seemed like they were definitely getting those teachings of mindfulness in every activity. But I'm just wondering, I haven't done so much reading, in a lot of those, Lhunta Mahabua's teachings, are they not so much focused on daily life? But it's like those teachings were there, but people just didn't feel like it was important to write that down,
I don't know. I never really lived with Ajahn Mahabua.
I guess why I phrase it that way is that's the sort of, I guess there's, with different teachers, there's different teachings that to me, I hear this sort of re-emphasized and over and over again. For example, one person, and the knowing and so forth. And with Lopur Shad, that's just one that I hear repeatedly. With Ajahn Mahabua, the ones that come up, and they're not the only ones that he discusses, obviously, but for me, the ones that come up the most are the emphases on determination,
effort.
And effort, yeah.
Effort.
Those are the two.
Ajahn Mahabua is really, get in there and, put some effort in. Fight for that that realization. I guess a lot of it is temperament and what's worked for them. Like Ajahn Mahabhu, I got teased by Ajahn Mun for being a... it's just like an old boxer. No finesse whatsoever. Get in there and slug it out.
So he's also interested in relation to the emphasis on termination effort is that there's a story about one long time got his samadhi together, and he really obviously got it together. That Lumpur Mun was like, and he was just, I don't know if he was literally laying about, but he wasn't apparently hitting the investigation wisdom. And something like Ajahn Mun, I don't know if it was verbatim, but essentially, all right, lazy bastard, didn't work.
Yeah.
And I mean, that connects pretty
directly
with teaching. See, and obviously, it isn't all he teaches.
Yeah.
But.
I know from someone who's never really spent any time around these teachers that, and just thinking about the life we live here, just when I read an Ajahn Mahabhu talk, maybe how, and just get the sense that it's just only this thin cross section of what it was like to live with these teachers,
right.
And especially like the Q&A with Ajahn Dick just presented this this whole different dimension to what it's like to live with the Kuba Ajahn. How, just a text somewhere can't capture it.
Yeah, it's kind of similar with the, just sort of very similar with the, like you read the suttas, and you don't really get a feel for what the Buddha's teachings are until you really study and put in practice the Vinaya, where the... where the Buddha's taking the life and how much the rules of training, deportment, looking after the kuti, the sauna, the toilets, and it's everything is an incredible amount of detail. How much detail is put into communal harmony and the sharing and care of the requisites. It's a, you realize how much that fills out those aspects of the sutta of teachings on right view and right practice.
Something that comes to mind is something I struggle with a lot of practice. Struggle is not just, unless ironically use a word, but it's trying to find the kind of the trick, so to speak, where effort becomes effortless,
right.
Where consistent mindfulness doesn't become such a difficult challenge.
Right.
Because you can read teachings where they're just effort after effort, you have to persevere, but then at some point, if you are able to maintain that, it becomes pretty easy.
Yeah.
But then it's sometimes difficult to sustain.
Yeah.
So it's kind of both there, and so I've always thought about this a lot. Sometimes you hear a skilled, advanced teacher speak almost from one of those perspectives,
right.
And then sometimes you hear speakers who can speak from both of those perspectives, saying how they both kind of work. I don't know if you have any suggestions.
Well, I think one of the things is there's a certain kind of paradox or something to be reflected on in terms of, say, like the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. Okay, these are the kind of the template that the Buddha gave toward the end of his life that really lay out this path to awakening. And the Dhamma the quality that is most often comes up in is effort. I think it's 9 different points that are addressing effort. But then you look at the definition of right effort, and it's not actually about what you do, but it's about the quality of the mind. So the effort that elicits wholesome dhammas and undermines unwholesome dhammas. So it's like then it starts to be, that's where it starts to become effortless, is where we use that external application of effort to shine a light on the quality of mind that we're bringing to the effort, whether it's one of restraint or a quality of stilling or of bringing into being something. But we have to pay attention to the nature of the quality of mind. And so that's where the effort starts to become more effortless. But we have to learn how to attend to that skillfully. And it takes a long time.
How important in that is like contentment and joy in the object that you pick up? Like I know like some people, you know, like reading, it's like you're studying, like, you know, they might mind if they had the opportunity, like 5 hours would pass, or maybe with painting, like, you know, it just becomes completely joyful and effortless.
That's an aspect of it, certainly. And but then it also, what has been the object of that contentment and joy? What has been the substance of that and joy? So that it should also be shining a light on the nature of relinquishment or of emptiness, right? Something that nurtures the understanding of the true nature of things.
That's kind of like,
but it can be sort of an intellectual analysis, which is kind of.
Yeah. I was thinking like more in terms of like say the contentment aspect of it, because it's like if it's an object that doesn't bring contentment, it's like you're not going to get absorbed into it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Just kind of knowing that.
Yeah. Yeah. But then also sometimes, just because we can't get absorbed in it right away, mm-hmm. we can't be content with it right away, it doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong or bad. This is where reflection and investigation is so important. And the context of what is it that aligns with Dhamma? What is for the overcoming of suffering?
I'm drawing a blank. The suttas, I think there's a stock passage for what is the basis or leads into right effort. Is that investigation of teachings? Is that?
Oh, yeah. In terms of the seven factors of enlightenment, then Dhammavicaya is your preceding causal factor for the arising of effort.
I'm thinking of maybe the chain that leads to these like drawing close to the teacher.
Right, stream of factors. There's several suttas like that. I'm drawing a blank off the top of my head.
It might be coming to a reflective understanding of the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
You do that, after hearing the teachings and pondering them,
coming to a
reflective understanding.
Yeah.
Then I think striving is next.
Yeah.
Is it striving or is it by effort or experience?
Yeah. I think my memory is striving, but I don't trust it.
I guess I'm asking because I think one of the presumptions my mind has this old is that when I get inspired, I put forth effort. Just not right effort. It's like the effort that drives me mad. It kind of makes me go and just bump my head.
Right.
Rather than my right effort.
Right.
So that's,
yeah, and I think that's where the. That's where that template of how the Buddha defines right effort is so important to be lifting up in terms of, okay, I'm inspired, I'm energetic, but how does that line up according to those four aspects of right effort? And it's really, really important to reflect on that. Yeah.
I really appreciated what you mentioned, maybe with right effort, it's not just a matter of how little or how much.
Yeah.
It's about that quality.
It's quality of mind.
Because I noticed too that the inspiration that leads to good effort also has that sort of disenchantment cooling thing going with it.
Yeah.
Like there's an energy, but it's a cool energy, yeah, in a sense. And also maybe a viraga in terms of shrinking back from the external stuff, as opposed to getting involved in a sewing project, there's a different sort of vibration.
One thing I've been working on, just beginning to get some sense of and continuity of mindfulness, is just being able to stay with a particular pattern of breathing during activity, and then noticing that is if some level of enjoyment or ease with the breathing stays there, then the mind says, the mind doesn't want to jump. It is, it actually feels, the mind, finally the mind wants to, it's not, as you said, I think you once said it, sometimes I wonder, my mind is really quiet. And that's something I've been, just beginning to, investigate, develop. And I was wondering if you had any advice with developing that.
I was wondering, just taking interest in it and just exploring, realizing that that's a possibility. And just that sense of content and delightment with something as simple as being with the breath, being with the quiet mind. Okay, great discussion.